1、2、3。
But fortunately, it was nothing like what happened back in the Tohoku earthquake back in 2011.
Right, so that the anniversary is coming very soon, March 11th.
Yeah, yeah.
And that one was huge. That one was the, yeah, like Burke said earlier, one of the biggest earthquakes in recorded history.
Yeah, do you remember where you were when that one happened?
I was working for a language school, and we were... I was teaching on the 7th floor of a building, so that building shook pretty hard. Well, the thing is, because it happened in Tohoku and being in Hokkaido, I think it was only about a 3.
Yeah.
On the scale.
Yeah.
But you could tell just by the shaking of the building that felt quite big, and I was thinking, the source must be huge.
Yeah, the other thing is that one lasted for like 6 minutes or something. So yeah. I remember we were sitting in our office and it started to shake. And it's like, okay, so this is a earthquake happening. Everyone's kind of stops what they're doing. And again, they sit around and they kind of wait, when is this going to stop? And then like it just continued on. And finally, the president of the company was like, okay, this is kind of lasting quite a while. Let's evacuate the building.
What floor were you on? Were you on a high floor?
We were on the 6th floor, but it was a pretty big office building. So, I mean, it was shaking, and we could tell, like, something was different about this one. But it wasn't, like, too scary or anything. It was just that it lasted very long, yeah.
Yeah, I think being in Hokkaido, we didn't really realize how bad it was.
Yeah, well,
until you switch on the TV.
Exactly. Well, that was the thing. Like, after it happened, we came back in, and I think an aftershock happened shortly after that. But people were kind of checking their phones, and like, oh, something like happened in Tohoku. And this was actually kind of before social media. So people were checking their phones for information, but there's not too much. And some people were saying, like, oh, there's a fire breaking out somewhere in Tokyo or something. But yeah, we were kind of oblivious to what happened. Until, like, I went home that night, and I turned on the TV, and I saw the tsunami happen.
Oh, that was great. I think that was probably what did the most damage, was the tsunami.
Yeah, so did you not know anything until you went home and turned on the TV,
and
too?
I switched the TV on, and the first image I saw was a tsunami just wiping out this town, and just people on the roofs, wiping buildings out, cars... And, yeah, it was scary to see that.
Yeah, it was really weird because, too, the TV, like, I mean, obviously every channel is just news about what's happening. And all of the TV reporters are wearing, like, helmets on TV.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I don't remember that.
Yeah, and they're just, like, and, like, every few minutes or seconds, like, they're like, oh, another earthquake, another aftershock is happening, another one's happening, this one's this big, blah, blah, blah. And they're like... all like halfway panic state, you know, so that kind of like makes you scared as well, because everyone on TV is kind of like, you see how like panicky everyone is. And then I remember some people told me like they were overseas and they like watched the whole tsunami approach and like cause damage.
What is like a video of like watching the? Oh yeah, I remember seeing one.
They
kept replaying that scene over and over again on the news, just seeing the wave, the giant tsunami just hitting into this town, and it was devastating.
Yeah, well, it's like shocking because like I didn't even know what to do, man. It was like I just remember feeling like, we gotta go, like, help people.
Yeah, we were helpless, completely helpless. And I remember I was in a bar. I mean, I went down to my local bar, and they had it on a TV. And I'm just sitting there with like all the local drinkers and the managers and stuff. And we're just looking at this screen, like dumbfounded. You know, this is happening where we are in Japan, but we're still pretty far away though.
Yeah, and it's kind of like,
almost felt like we were in a completely different place.
Yeah, but then you kind of start to feel like, I gotta do something, you know? Like, these people, like, they're going through this right now. Like, what are we going to do? And I'm like thinking, like, how do we get down there? Like, what do we do? And I remember going to work and just thinking, like, how are we going to, like, just continue with regular work right now? Shouldn't we be, like, going down there and trying to do something? And but, it, you know, obviously business needs to continue and everything. So, but in the end, like, within a couple of days, our company formed, like, an emergency volunteer team. And we ended up sending people down to that area for, like, the next 6 or 8 weeks or something.
Wow, that's awesome, man. Like pretty much straight after.
Well, because obviously what happened is after the big earthquake hit and the tsunami and everything, they have to wait for the situation to kind of calm down because they don't want to be having volunteers come into, like, a disaster that's waiting to happen again. So I think it wasn't necessarily, like, it was probably not immediately the next week, but from the second week after they started to, I mean, the government and all the organizations started to kind of form a system to be able to start to accept volunteers to go down there. And that's when we started sending people. I didn't go as one of those groups, but actually I went down to that area.
Fukushima.
I went with the president of my company. And we had somebody from an office in that area. And again, this thing like hit like a few hundred kilometer area on the coast of just damage. And we actually started in Ibaraki near just north of Tokyo. And over 2 days, we drove all the way north and stopped at all the different areas along the way up to the top of Honshu. And because we were doing information collection, because again, our company is for agriculture, so we were trying to see like what situation the customers were in the disaster that happened in the nuclear power plant.
Right, so that's another thing. Like, they had the earthquake, then the tsunami, and then the radiation problem. It was just like a three hit in one go. And that was probably the worst one, right? Maybe the radiation as well, because that's still kind of ongoing.
Yeah, and I think that affects not just people in Japan, but people overseas are worried about, like, obviously how does it affect marine life, the food that they're eating as well. But so we went to, like, some of our customers in the area who are farmers, large farmers, and one of the craziest things I remember seeing, besides the disaster areas, which were just like, I'll get into that in a little bit. But for example, a lot of dairy farmers, they don't know if the milk is healthy. Where actually it's like determined already that's not healthy. So they would dig these huge, huge pits into the ground that are like 30 meters long, 20 meters wide, and like 20 meters deep. And they would just dump all this milk in there into this pit. And then they would just have to bury the milk because it couldn't be used. And they would do like, they would dig like a few pits on their farmland, you know?
Did they like kill all the cows and make a mass cow grave?
In some places, I'm trying to remember if that's how they ended up having to deal with the cows. I can't remember. But I just remember that all of the milk couldn't be used. I mean, for a long time, several months, many, many months probably. And
well,
then, like,
even now, I mean, a lot of people don't buy food from that area.
Yeah, they don't buy produce from that area. I remember
about,
we didn't for
how
a
about
while.
You?
No,
how about now?
No, no. For, well, to be honest, like, unfortunately, I think now, like, maybe even supermarkets and stuff hold off on maybe buying food from that area, because I'm sure after that, like, people, like you said, just weren't buying it. But
yeah,
I remember,
we still don't buy food. Like, every time my girlfriend goes grocery shopping, she's always looking at where it's from, and the food that is from that area is always markedly lower.
The crazy thing is that there, even those areas where they determined like it is not safe, not just people like worried about it not being safe, but they actually designated it as not being safe, they've started to let them like
go
grow
back
rice again, and go back in those areas. And
see, that is a bit crazy, because I read somewhere, hold on, I found this article. So the government, even though the area, like, now is still not safe for people to live there, they've risen the allowable radiation limit. They've raised it up so that people have to go back, because the people were getting subsidies before. Around 35,000 citizens still wait to return to this area, but they and many others throughout northeastern Japan worry all of this is too soon, because in some places the measure of the radiation is 5 millisieverts beyond the natural background radiation. And that is 5 times the added level that the Japanese government increased, I mean, recommended.
I understand, like, people want to return to their homes and where they grew up and everything, but I just don't agree with that.
Yeah, I don't think they want to return, but they can't afford not to.
Oh, they can't get their subsidies anymore,
Yeah, because that limit's raised now. And suppose it's because the government want them to go back in preparation for the Olympics, the 2020 Olympics, which happening next year.
Okay.
So I guess they want to kind of put this whole disaster behind them, so people that come to Japan are not going to be thinking about radiation anymore.
Hey, Japanese government, I don't think that's going to work, because I think people overseas are, I mean, it became more of a hot topic overseas about how dangerous Japan, I mean, people still joke about it, they won't even go visit that area anymore, and I don't think just because you make people return to that area, that's going to convince people overseas that it's all of a sudden safe or something.
Right, right. Well, do you remember during that time, what was your reaction?
Well, just in terms of the earthquake or the tsunami?
The whole episode, because, well, you know, like how the TEPCO, which is, TEPCO is like they power the power station, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So they were like withholding information at that time.
Yeah, I think they still are. I think, like, if you watch information that is put out there by overseas media group versus what's put out there in Japan, sometimes it's completely different.
Yeah. So they were saying that because of that reason of what happened during that disaster, that no one is trusting any news that is coming out of Fukushima now. So if they're saying, oh, it's safe to go back, the food is okay to eat, no one trusts them anymore.
Well, they
because
shouldn't.
Of that situation.
I mean, it goes pretty deep because, again, after that whole thing happened, renewable energy, fortunately, kind of got a big push in Japan because people were so worried about what can happen with the nuclear power plant. I can't remember exactly how many nuclear power plants there are in Japan, but a lot of those got stopped afterwards for safety inspection because of what all the meltdown and that happened in Fukushima and everything. Now when people say, oh, they're going to start the nuclear power plants up again, people don't necessarily trust it. They think, like, are the power companies just trying to make money again?
Yeah.
So, just like you said, a lot of doubt was created. But
yeah, exactly. So they don't trust the Japanese media anymore.
Yeah, well,
because, I mean, during that time, I was getting all my news from, like, British newspapers.
Sure, yeah.
And it was very different from what the Japanese news was saying at the time. The Japanese news was saying, no, there's not really a problem going on. Yeah. There's no radiation. The factories are fine. And it wasn't until a couple of days later that they started to admit, actually, there is a problem.
Yeah.
But by then, you know, like, especially the foreign community in Japan, people are already leaving.
Yeah, well, I remember the U.S. Consulate and the U.S. Embassy in Tokyo and in Sapporo, they were recommending that citizens leave the country. And I think they were, if I remember correctly. And I remember that a lot of government workers actually did leave the country. Actually, my brother and his family were in Tokyo at the time, and his wife and the children went back to the U.S. for several months, like a few months, when this was all happening.
Because of that?
Well, they were in Tokyo, so again, they were worried. I mean, there was a lot of fear that was created, and obviously a lot of it was legitimate, but you know, they didn't know how much of the water supply was being affected by what was happening at the nuclear power plant, how much radiation people should be concerned about, how safe the food was. And I would have done the same thing, man. I would have put all my kids on a plane and had them leave and, you know, make sure they're in a safe place.
Did you think about leaving Japan at that point?
You know, I didn't, and I think it was because we're up in Sapporo, and a lot of the stuff was kind of, I mean, Sapporo's kind of upwind, upcurrent and everything.
Yeah.
From what was going on down
there.
You
know what was really strange or interesting was that when the news, or especially the international papers, were reporting on the incident, they were saying in northeastern Japan, which is basically where we are, so but it's not really northeast Japan because we're in northeast Japan. Hokkaido is northeast.
Oh, right, because they refer to northeast Japan as like the northern part of Honshu.
Yeah, yeah. Which is like if you look at the map, it's more central eastern Japan.
Well, a lot of people joke about it. The Hokkaido is not Japan.
Yeah. But because of that, all my family were like, you know, messaging me, hey, you got to get out. Are you okay? Yeah, you know, my mom was like, but there's radiation open. But I was telling her, we're so far away. Like, we are really north Japan.
Yeah.
But that Tohoku is not really northeast Japan. So I was a bit annoyed about how the news was referring to that because it was creating unnecessary panic for my family, I think, back at home.
Yeah.
So I was trying to defend Hokkaido and how safe it was, and they're like, no, you're going to get radiation, you're going to die. And
hey, eventually, like maybe Hokkaido should get its independence anyways, because we are kind of like our own place up here, and we've got the whole beautiful nature up here, so, you know.
And it's still new, it's like only, what, 200 years old? Like, well, it's been a part of Japan.
Yeah, and it doesn't have a lot of the same cultural, like, landmarks that you find down in other areas, so it's kind of a little bit of its own country, yeah. But kind of going back, though, to, you know, because we went to that area, and again, like, the whole area is wiped out. You can't even imagine what it's like, you know, because there's nothing there. And one thing that really stuck in my mind is, so all these houses and all these buildings are completely destroyed and gone away, but they'd have, like, these red flags in front of, like, each destroyed house, and it basically meant that, like, people, the search parties had gone to that house and had not found any, like, survivors or bodies or anything. So I just remember we were kind of driving in a car, like, through the streets where everything was kind of had been washed away. And, yeah, there's just, like, these red flags in front of each site to signify that it had been checked and stuff. But that's kind of, like, one thing that people don't realize is that tsunami, you know, when you think about it growing up or you don't really know what it is, you just think, like, it's, like, this huge, like, wave of water that comes, like, washing over. But what it is actually all the sand from the bottom of the ocean gets pushed up into this. Basically, the wave is not a wave of water. It's a wave of sand that just comes into the city and, like, destroys and pushes everything over that's in its way. And so, again, like, the cleanup after that takes so much time because you're not just waiting for the water to recede, but after the water recedes, you have all this, like, sand everywhere and everything. So,
well, and they're still recovering from it now.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I found this article in the Washington Post, and this was written, February 2019, and 8 years after Fukushima's meltdown, the land is recovering, but the public don't trust what the news is saying, basically about how they're saying the food is safe to eat, food and vegetables, and fishing has started again. But the radiation levels are still a bit dubious. Yeah.
I wouldn't even know what to think, man. I actually know somebody whose family is, extended family is from that area. And, you know, they kind of, like, gave the designation of how many, like, the radius of what's safe, how many kilometers away from the nuclear power plant. And their extended family's place, their relative's place is outside of that radius. But it's still kind of like, should you really feel safe going there? I mean, I don't want to...
You don't want to be near the radius, though, at all, really. You know,
yeah, but...
If you have the choice or the option of not
being there. Yeah, it's so hard to say because you don't want to kind of discriminate against the area. But at the same time, like, you really worry for...
Yeah, I think especially if you have young children involved, like if you're a bit older, then maybe not so much. But when you got like babies and kids, because they're obviously more susceptible to radiation.
Yeah, I mean, what will you do? Risk, yeah, because we have like a nuclear power plant up here in Hokkaido, right?
Yeah, but it's been shut down, hasn't it? Because of after the main one, and that was quite close. I remember I had a student that worked there. Actually, so this was it was before the big earthquake, and he was saying that he worked in a nuclear power plant in Yoichi, it was. I was like, you're not worried, like, if, you know, someone attacks it or something like that? And he was very confident, He was very pro nuclear power.
He's not working for TEPCO, is he?
Maybe he is now, yeah. But, I mean, he's not working there anymore. So, yeah.
I mean, I don't know. Have you ever thought that maybe you want to leave Japan because of...
Yeah, I don't know.
The natural disasters?
I mean, being in Hokkaido, I didn't think so. But after that big earthquake in September, it made me double think about possibly leaving Japan. Possibly a very small one. Yeah, last summer after that earthquake. It made me kind of think twice about the safetiness of it, of Japan. Because I always thought Hokkaido was immune to the rest of Japan before that earthquake.
Yeah, well, that was the thing, is because the one that happened in 2003, I thought was just an anomaly. I didn't think Hokkaido could have big earthquakes. And now that big one happened in September, and we're still feeling the aftershocks of that. So it kind of makes you worry. But now they're even talking about there's a big possibility of the huge earthquake hitting down on Honshu again, not in the Tohoku area.
Like Tokyo?
Yeah, within the next 30
years.
Yeah,
I read that somewhere.
And they're starting to say those deep sea fish, they're like a harbinger. I say harbinger.
Harbingers.
not the fish. But anyways, fish. Cut that out, please, man. The fish are kind of like a sign because they live in the deep sea. That something's rumbling. Man, can I just go off on a tangent real quick?
Sure.
Okay. Cause I gotta talk about this, man. Ever since we've been recording these, I've just realized how many English mistakes I make.
You've been living in Japan too long, that's why.
I think it is, but you know what else it is, man? I've sacrificed my English for the sake of Japanese. Not saying because I've learned more Japanese words, my English has worsened, but I've picked up a bad habit from studying Japanese. I kind of got in this habit sometimes of just I don't do it as much anymore because my Japanese has improved, but I would just kind of throw words out there and whatever sticks, you know, or.
What do you mean? Using Japanese English phrases, you mean?
No, not making stuff up, but just kind of I wouldn't really care so much about the grammar, just kind of throw out the words that I could throw out there and wait for them to figure out what I was saying, you know? And I think that's affected my English, where sometimes I just kind of I know this isn't the right word, but this person will know what I'm saying.
I know what you mean. I know exactly what you mean. That's happened to me. And also, I always kind of I've been doubting my English a lot more recently.
Yeah.
I'll read some grammatically incorrect sentences, but then I've read that mistake so many times that now I think, actually, it might be right.
Yeah.
When it's not right.
You talk yourself out of it and stuff. But, man, particularly listening to this podcast, I hear myself say all these words that are either not the correct form of the word or not even the correct meaning, but similar, kind of close and stuff.
How about talking about words? Should we teach some of the listeners some useful Japanese?
Yeah, man,
possibly?
For sure. Yeah, yeah.
So if you're coming to Japan, visiting or living, a very good first word to learn, in my opinion, is a sumimasen, which means, has a lot of meanings. It could mean a lot of things. It could mean excuse me is probably the direct translation, maybe.
Yeah.
But you could also use it to mean sorry and even thank you in some situations, right?
Right, thanking somebody for going through the trouble of doing something.
Right, so you can use sumimasen all the time. If you buy something or if you want to get past someone, just say sumimasen. If someone gives you something, you can say sumimasen, because thank you for taking the trouble to give me something.
Yeah, because if you just say thank you, domo or arigato or something, they'll think it's almost too much, you're putting yourself above that person. It's not recognizing what they've done for you. Yeah.
So sumimasen.
Sumimasen.
And also, it's very good to ask for things too. So, like, if you're in a restaurant, you want to get the bill, just summa send it. You know, you can summa send your order.
Yeah, there's kind of a skill that goes with, like, being able to say that at a restaurant to get the waiter or waitress's attention.
The right volume and the right tone. I'm not very good at it. I always have to give it a good 3 times before that they kind of notice that I'm trying to get their attention.
Yeah, girls are really good at it, man. They, like, know the perfect pitch. Like, my wife, she talks really quietly, but, like, the waiter or waitress will be, like, across the room. But she'll say it, like, that sweet spot point where they'll, like, notice it, even how far, no matter how far away they are.
Yeah, I haven't got that right yet. I think you've got it down pretty well, though. I mean, you got the accent. You got to get the accent right down, too, right?
Yeah, well, I think the secret to it is kind of elongating the end of the word. Because then they just kind of hear that much. They hear the sen.
Give us an example.
They're just like, summa sen. Because they hear that.
All right, so extend the ending.
Yeah, and they just kind of hear that much. They're like, oh, okay.
Yeah. All right, I'll try that next time.
Yeah, so we kind of went off on this tangent, so summa sen deshita.
Yeah, summa sen deshita. Good. What else, sir? Anything else you want to talk about?
Well, so, yeah, these earthquakes that are happening, I don't think it should scare anyone from visiting Japan. In fact, we just had this aftershock that happened, and I had some friends that came here this week to go snowboarding in Niseko. And even though we had that aftershock that was pretty big a couple weeks ago, you know, I told them, you know, come, don't worry about it. You know, don't let these things make people worry about coming to Japan, because that was actually something.
Did it make big news, like, abroad? I think it did, right?
Yeah, actually, one person did write to me and just ask if things were okay. But one thing that happened after the March 11th earthquake is that a lot of people left Japan. Obviously, people living here, the expats, but people stopped coming.
A lot of people, yeah, quit their jobs or even requested transfers. A lot of people actually came to Hokkaido after that big the big earthquake in March in 2011.
Yeah,
so they thought it was the safest place to be.
Yeah, and it definitely, like, hurt the economy. I mean, we got the Olympics coming up next year, so I really don't want it to discourage people. But I do know that it has taught me a lot about emergency preparedness. And just like you were saying, we've got a lot of, like, goods that we've brought together for an emergency.
So you're prepared for another earthquake.
Oh, yeah. I mean, everything from, like, I bought a lot of, like, food supplies that last for, like, 3 years, you know, just.
Yeah, we bought, like, this kind of food off Amazon where it's got, like, a lot of, I don't even know what it is. It's kind of like space food, you know, like that the astronauts take into space. So you can eat it in, like, any conditions, and it's got all the vitamins and you need and stuff like that. Yeah. But I don't think it tastes very good, though.
No, well, the good thing is that I think Japan has their emergency preparedness down well enough that even if you have these emergency rations, it doesn't mean that you need to survive on them for, like, a month. You may only need to survive on them for a few days before they get everything figured out how they're going to deal with the situation. So,
did you think Hokkaido was prepared for that last earthquake, the big one last summer?
Like the people or the city and
the
stuff?
The city, yeah. Like, I don't feel like they were, just because of the lack of generators. I mean, surely you should. I mean, I know hospitals had them. And maybe some ward offices had them. But, like, if you went, like, downtown, you know, when you go down into Suskino, like, I remember one of my friends, he actually went out down into the entertainment district one night of the earthquake, and he just said, yeah, everything was lights off. But there was a couple of restaurants that actually had some power.
So you're saying, like, Suskino should be more prepared to keep the party going?
Yeah, exactly. You know, someone's got to keep the people entertained.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're not going to work. They need to do something, right?
Yeah, that's their job, isn't it? Their job is to feed people and get them drinking.
Yeah,
you know, take their mind off things, maybe.
Again, I will say, like, the supermarkets and stuff, I felt like they were pretty prepared. But yeah, I don't think, I don't think it was as prepared as it could have been. But I remember just even after the recent big one happened a few years ago in Kyushu, and people were, like, having to live in their cars for a few days, because that one happened, like, in the middle of the summer too. and it was really, really hot. And I'm just glad we didn't have to like try to experience something like that here in Hokkaido, where like power was off for like a month or something, you know?
Yeah, nice. So should we should we go over to some questions?
Yeah,
some listener questions.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you want us to answer your questions, send them to, what's the address again?
VoicesInJapan@gmail.com.
Right, VoicesInJapan@gmail.com. We also have a Twitter account and Instagram, Facebook as well. So yeah, leave your name and where you're from and your question. So yeah, let's have a look what we got. Found one. This is Lucy from Bolton. Lucy from Bolton. You know where Bolton is, Burke?
Yeah, it's in England.
It is in England. Well done. So boom. Lucy from Bolton, that's north of England, the opposite of where I'm from. And she says, she asks, what are your favorite foods in Japan? Burke, what's your favorite food in Japan?
This is a great question, man. I guess
she's assuming it's Japanese food.
Yeah, this is banana. Now, this is good because I've been thinking we should do like a food episode, you know? Oh, especially definitely. Being in Sapporo, because we got great food here. Man, it's hard to pick just one. I mean, obviously, number one is my wife's cooking.
Yes, our home Japanese home cooking is probably the best.
I mean, but I send photos and stuff of that like to people back home, and they just think I'm eating out like at a restaurant every day.
What is, I mean, can you get that kind of cooking in restaurants, like home cooking in Japanese restaurants?
Probably not. I think there's a difference for sure.
Yeah.
But so if I were to say like my favorite food to go out and eat with people, would probably be shabu shabu, and I don't even know if this is like originally Japanese or not. It might be Chinese based.
We definitely eat that in Hong Kong. So yeah, shabu shabu. I think it's a little bit different though. Like they definitely do it better in Japan.
Yeah.
It seems like the food, the meat quality is better. So yeah. So what is shabu shabu?
So shabu shabu is like you have boiling water, or if you go to certain places, they actually flavor the boiling water. You use the water to cook or boil very very thinly cut meat. So the meat is cut very very thin, so that when you put it in the water with the chopsticks, and actually make, and the name shabu shabu comes from the noise of like putting the food into the water and doing shabu shabu shabu.
And it's usually pork, right? The meat.
Is it? Yeah, I usually order beef.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So maybe, but definitely not chicken.
No.
But because it's always very thinly sliced.
Yeah, but you can, I mean, they do serve chicken as well, but you got to leave it in the water for a little while before it's ready to eat. But yeah, this very thinly cut meat cooks within like, you know, seconds, like 10 seconds or something. And then you dip it in sauce, and at the same time, like, you fill up all the boiling water with a bunch of vegetables like mushrooms and lettuce and cabbage and all these other sorts of vegetables that you can eat at the same time.
Yeah, if anyone's seen the movie Lost in Translation with Bill Murray and who's that girl?
Scarlett
Johansson. Yeah, so they go to a shabu shabu restaurant, and Bill Murray, and they show him the menu, and basically all the pictures look exactly the same, but basically they're just different kinds of meat or different quality, maybe.
Yeah,
different cuts.
And the place that I like going in Sapporo is they actually split the dish with the boiling water into two, and so you can choose what type of water it's boiled in, like tofu based water or some kind of sauce based water or something.
I do like shabu shabu, yeah.
What is your favorite food, though?
For me, I actually like soup curry.
Soup curry.
So soup curry is a Hokkaido food, yeah. So it's from Hokkaido. And I remember when I first came here, I was thinking, because like, being from England, we always have like Indian curry. It's like a big dish back at home.
Yeah.
And so when I came here, I was thinking, oh, is it Indian curry but soupy?
Yeah.
And that would be terrible.
Yeah, who wants to eat soupy curry?
Exactly. Yeah. But I was so surprised because it's nothing like that at all. So it's just a soup-based curry, But every restaurant or establishment, they have their own recipes. They put a lot of herbs and spices, so it doesn't taste anything like Indian curry at all. It's just like a spicy soup,
yeah,
in a way.
And it's all sometimes like people specifically have it for that spiciness, but it's really, really good. They have like different, it's kind of like Indian curry in the sense that they do have different levels to the spiciness.
Yeah, stuff, yeah. But usually like you have, maybe you'd have like a chicken soup curry, so you'd have a chicken in the soup with some vegetables, and then you'd have a side plate of rice, and then you'd get a spoon of rice, dip into the soup, and then eat the vegetables, or, you know, however you like. But then you'd have like pork or beef dish, or natto sometimes, which is really good. Hamburger even, which is really good. Yeah, and each restaurant has their own unique soup. So, and in Sapporo, there's hundreds of soup curry restaurants, and they're all kind of competing for each other. There's like a soup curry culture for sure. And if you know, go online and you find like people that blog about it, that are trying different kind of soup curries. And yeah, and like Burke was saying, there's the spice levels. So some places range from zero spice to maybe 100. I don't know how someone could eat 100 level soup curry spice level. But some places they only do like 0 to 5 or 0 to 10. I'm a bit of a wimp. I kind of go pretty low. I go usually like 2 or 3.
2 or 3, same here. Yeah.
But some of my friends, they always like go for they max it out. You know, for them, it's more like it's like fun, you know, like an entertainment to see how much spice they can eat.
Yeah.
But I prefer to enjoy my food.
Yeah. Nice, man. Nice. Yeah. Soup curry. Love it. Love it.
Yep. Soup curry from Sapporo and shabu shabu. So that's that was from Lucy. Thank you, Lucy.
Yeah. Should I?
Pull up a question, man.
Okay, this is Steve from California. What's up, Steve? Thank you for giving us shooting us a question here. Steve says he is going to be visiting Japan soon, probably Tokyo or one of the big cities. And his question is, oh, this is a good one. He says, obviously, I would like to meet people while I'm there, maybe even a girl. Is there any advice you can give me on how to meet Japanese women?
Oh.
Steve.
Interesting question. Probably could be a whole episode on this one.
yeah, it could be. But let's maybe try to give them a preview. What would you say is one? Well, because I would say, look, there's two types of people that come here or that get here and want to meet Japanese women. There are the ones who think that you need to speak Japanese or have some, you know, clever pickup line in Japanese to meet a Japanese girl. But I'm going to tell everyone a little bit of a secret here. If you're a foreigner and you're trying to meet a Japanese girl, they probably want to meet you because you're a foreigner. So it's probably better for you to throw some of the English at them, because that's what they want to enjoy.
Yeah, use it to your advantage. You have that advantage already. So, yeah, take advantage of the advantage.
I mean, obviously, if you want to meet them and then you want to have a conversation with them, a little bit of Japanese helps. But, man, those girls that they're, you know, out of the bar and they see a foreign guy, maybe they just want to have, like, a good conversation with that foreign guy that night. So if you just go over to them and you're like, hello, then they're like...
Yeah, just, hi, what's your name? That works most of the time,
yeah,
you know. And usually most people, when you say that, they will tell you their name.
Yeah,
like they got to be pretty rude not to tell you their name.
Yeah,
I've met maybe a couple of people have done that, but they're a bit weird, I think, if they're gonna do that.
Yeah, after they've had a few drinks too, they're just looking to enjoy the night, and part of that for them could be like having a good conversation with a foreign guy. But I think we both have a few secret techniques that maybe we'll get into on
maybe another time. But also, like, especially if you're in Tokyo, it's probably a lot easier to meet people that would have a higher chance of speaking English. Especially if you go to, you know, bars or clubs in, you know, the main Shibuya areas or Roppongi especially.
If you want to meet somebody easily, go to Roppongi.
Yeah, if you want to meet someone that speaks English, Roppongi, you're guaranteed to meet a Japanese person that can speak English. They kind of go there to speak English too. So they're going to be looking for you, Steve. You won't have to look for them.
Steve, tell us how it went, man. We'll look forward to hearing how it went.
Yeah, shoot us some pictures on our Twitter or something, or Instagram us.
Yeah, here you go. Yeah, maybe we'll even send you back a gift or something.
Oh yeah, some merch.
Yeah, but thanks for the question, man. Appreciate that.
Yeah, cheers, Steve. All right, I think that's about time for this week. Hope you enjoyed the episode, everyone. And remember to tell your friends about the podcast if you enjoyed it, and go to iTunes, leave us a review, subscribe, which is, according to Burke, one of the most important things to get those viewerships up or listenership up. And thanks for listening.